The House comes to oral questions, and the first is in the name of the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Nice to see you in the chair.
Feels good.
At last. Madam Speaker, my question is to the Prime Minister and asks, does she stand by her explanation in the Parliament yesterday of the rationale for the government's proposed regime for charging some people who return to New Zealand part of the costs of their managed isolation? And is the proposed regime an example of good public policy?
I
call the Right Honourable, Mr. Peters. Will you?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes. This is a policy decision which has invited a mixed response across the political spectrum. And for only the second time in this government, the agree to disagree provisions of the coalition agreement have been invoked, which reflects how important this policy is to the political parties and, dare I say it, the New Zealand people.
What is the public policy justification for managed isolation charges applying to people who visit New Zealand for only a short period, but not charging people who decide to return home long-term, having previously chosen to live in another country?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that is one of the matters which, despite the law being introduced, which is the base for it, has yet to be clearly articulated or enunciated. That's a work in progress, and it means that, just like the National Party, whose previous leader and the third leader in the last 4 years has said that he was utterly opposed, the National Party was opposed to any charging regime just 5 weeks ago. That's what that means. It's still a work in progress, Mr. Smith.
Does that mean that her government will be passing legislation next week not knowing what it's going to do?
No, on behalf of the Prime Minister, the government knows entirely what it needs to do in terms of establishing... I'll get a cartoon to go with it, Mr. Smith, if you'd just be patient.
Order.
Well, Madam Chair, you know he's been out there sitting on the front bench, out of his seat. That's against the standing orders, as you well know. He's moved from the back, where he belongs,
just
to the front,
the
and he's misusing his position.
Just answer the question.
Right? Well, that's in the standing orders as well. But back to my point. The government is establishing the legislative regime, and it becomes triggered by, of course, the regulations which are yet to be written. That's what it means.
Can she confirm that costs of managed isolation out to the 31st of December this year are budgeted to be $479 million, taking the annualised costs close to $1 billion? And if so, does she think a 2% contribution from those fraction of returnees is fair to the New Zealand taxpayer?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that was the position that the opposition took just 5 weeks ago. It is the case at the present time that there are governing parties that have different views, and we're just being honest and direct with the population out there. And the people who will prevail will be the people who will prevail on this issue, no doubt, will be those who are here to write the law post the 19th of September.
Mr. Speaker.
First of all, there was a question being asked, so interruptions are not to be made, and then that invokes a response which doesn't help the order of the House. The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
If the government's policy advice was that only $125 million of the $479 million could be collected in border charges, is it good public policy to reject $125 million in income for less than $10 million in income?
Look, on behalf of the Prime Minister, that is the issue which is at variance within the coalition government and, dare I say it, the support party, the Greens. It happens to be the circumstance now that we find that the last leader and present leader of the National Party agrees with a charging regime. And as I say, long term, I can see this issue will be decided post the 2020 election. But I want to say, with respect to the National Party's latest stance and where it fits with New Zealand First, that it puts me in mind of Winston Churchill's famous comment, the trouble of being on the side of right is you keep so much dubious company.
Well, I just say to the member who's resuming his seat, it actually puts me in mind of Speaker's ruling 1594 from Speaker Wilson, that the Prime Minister is not responsible for the decisions of another party and can address questions as long as she does not address the other party's attitude on it. The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Will the government release today, or before the House debates the bill, all of the Crown law advice and other legal advice that it is alleged to warn against managed isolation charges?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I would like to answer that question, but I think that would be more rightly placed with the Minister handling this, namely my colleague Megan Woods, the Honourable Megan Woods. In the meantime, if the member had given me more notice, I'd have come down with the answer.
Madam Speaker, can I ask, when the Prime Minister negotiated the managed isolation payment scheme with Winston Peters, did she find that he was, and I quote him, a lamb in Parliament and a lion in the electorate? And is that why New Zealand First has now rolled over to vote for this?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, it's above my dignity to try and even answer that stupid question.
Question number two is also in the name of the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, does she stand by her reaction to job losses at the warehouse? Quote, I'm angry. If so, is she also angry at the more than 65,000 other New Zealanders have lost their jobs since March?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, in regards to the first part of the question, most definitely yes. We regard any loss of livelihood a personal tragedy for the individual involved and for their families and their loved ones. In regards to the second part of the question, the member is incorrect. According to the Stats New Zealand filled jobs measure, for which there are charts, total job numbers are up 38,000 on the same time last year. Wow. I have the data for 2019 and 20 right here, and the member is welcome to see it. Budget 2020 forecasts, our investments will save 140,000 jobs over the next 4 years.
Madam Speaker, to the Prime Minister, can she name one policy that she has implemented beyond anger that's aimed at creating new jobs or new businesses for the 210,000 New Zealanders currently on job seeker support, or the many others who are on wage support, or those who've lost income, or those who've lost part-time work, so that they can get back into the workforce?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the very suggestion that she can't name one when she can name countless numbers of projects all around this country, growing all over the place. Well, 13,000 the PGF for a start.
Huh? Come on!
Yes, that's the long-range forecast. And when, for example, the biggest mussel farm in the world, Napoteke, gets going, and we put pharmaceuticals around that, I can see burgeoning industries all over this country, because this party and this government has got commitment and a vision, a real vision of where we're going into the future, not spend and hope.
Is the Prime Minister then aware that quite often pestilence and other atrocities for humans occurs when there is too much emphasis placed on long-range forecasts?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, I'm looking at one.
Does she think that her government's policies, such as lifting the minimum wage during the middle of a lockdown, have contributed to the closure of more than 70 retail outlets this year and the associated job losses?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that, against the growth of great economies like the Nordic economies, like, for example, Singapore and, dare I say, others, were all predicated on the need for higher wages to drive productivity and changes. We understand that. We don't subscribe to the neoliberal philosophy that the few and very few should get the privilege of being in an economy and the rest pay the price for it.
I call the Honourable The Honourable Grant Roberts.
In light of that last supplementary question, does the Prime Minister believe that the presence of a virus and its resulting 1-in-100-year economic shock may have a greater influence on job loss than any other factor the members opposite might raise?
Well, not according to him.
The Prime Minister, on behalf of the Prime Minister, I am a woman. Not a him. And answering for the Prime Minister, it is clear as daylight that this tragic visitation of a plague from offshore, which the rest of the world is wrestling with, and which we have been privileged by careful management to be the most successful, possibly the most successful country in the world, or one of the most successful ones, is something that has rapidly beset wealth in business and, did I say it, employment. We're very much focused on that. But had we failed, the circumstance would be so much worse and the prospect of recovery almost hopeless.
What employment effect will there be from 32,000 returning New Zealand residents to date who have been through the managed isolation system, and how does that compare to the employment effect of 32,000 migrants coming here for the first time?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I get the first part of that equation. The second part, seeing the immigration figures are the lowest since 1959, seem to have been plucked out of mid-air with no factual base whatsoever.
Point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Madam Speaker, that wasn't the question that I asked. May I repeat it?
Yes, I'm not sure that it was answered, yep. That it was addressed, I beg your pardon.
Thank you. What employment effect will there be from the 32,000 returning New Zealand citizens and residents who have been through the managed isolation so far, and how does that compare to that of 32,000 migrants coming here for the first time?
Again, on behalf of the Prime Minister, the first part of the equation is a fact. The second part by which we are meant to make the comparison does not, given that we're in the lowest immigration stats since 1959, even resemble the facts. Where are these 32,000 migrants that you say are coming?
No, what's the economic effect? That was the first part.
Mr. Brownlee, on behalf of the Prime Minister, come down with your mind organised to ask questions.
Just one idea.
Point of order, Madam Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Madam Speaker, apologies. The question asks about numbers of people, the effect of the people coming in on employment.
Yes, I understand that.
If it was the same number coming for through immigration, would it be the same effect?
I understand that, but the minister. I don't need any help because I don't need any help. Please sit down. What I'm saying is, I think that the question was addressed by the member actually disputing the figures that were used in the second part of the question. Further supplementary.
I'll perhaps ask it a different way. What is the employment effect that 32,000 returning New Zealanders or residents who've been through managed isolation up to this point will have compared to a similar number, had they come in as immigrants?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, these are the actual employment figures. The 32,500 actuals are also coming back. Our people have been facilitated by MFAT, who moved 80,000 people back to this country, and the rest offshore to number in total movements 150,000 without impairing our economy. But as for this abstract 32,500 replacing actual New Zealanders and being immigrants, we have no idea what the member's talking about, because it's not a fact.
Does the Prime Minister think that perhaps because she doesn't know what ordinary New Zealanders are thinking about, that it's time she did get in touch with the thousands who are out of work and losing jobs on a daily basis?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, these are the facts, not wanton misrepresentation cast in terms of parliamentary questions by somebody who should know a whole lot better.
Question number three, Anahila Kanongataha Suisui King.
Kia ora te mana whakawā.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question goes to the Minister of Health.
What announcements has he made about upgrading vital infrastructure at Auckland City Hospital?
Madam Speaker.
I call the Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Madam Speaker, yesterday I visited Auckland City Hospital to view the infrastructure upgrade program that they have been progressing using Budget 2018 funding of $275 million. This includes the upgrading and replacing key infrastructure. Just hold on for a moment. Upgrading and replacing key infrastructure, including lifts, fire protection systems, boilers, electrical substations and water systems. They have been making such good progress, Madam Speaker, that the government is now able to help fund the second phase of this very important work. So I was able to announce an additional $262 million for Auckland City Hospital that will help to fund new central plant and service tunnels, new tanks, pumps and air handling systems.
Pātai tāpiri.
Permit question.
Required?
Madam Speaker, most of the infrastructure at Auckland City Hospital is almost 50 years old, and the majority of the site relies on services from a central plant building. Infrastructure failure could compromise the entire hospital system's network and its ability to provide care to the care that New Zealanders need. Unfortunately, this is a risk for many of our hospitals up and down the country, and that's why we're improving hospital infrastructure and DHBs with a $3.5 billion allocation of funding for this purpose so far to date. The funding I confirmed yesterday brings this government's investment in core Auckland DHB assets to more than $500 million in just 2 years as we make up for a decade of neglect.
Pātai tāpiri, when the second phase of infrastructure upgrades at Auckland City Hospital get underway?
More good news, Madam Speaker. The work is already underway. Initial work like site investigation, surveys and testing are progressing well, and the physical work is due to begin in October. This is a significant piece of work, and at its peak, the project will require as many as 350 extra workers on site. Confirmation of this project sends a strong signal to the construction sector that the government has a rolling maul of major construction work to provide confidence and support to the businesses and their workers.
Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the Minister of Finance, does he agree with the Prime Minister who said yesterday, quote, "My advice would be to anyone who finds themselves currently unemployed and wishes to start their own business, don't for a moment think that you need to gamble with your retirement savings," end of quote.
Madam Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Madam Speaker, I agree with the Prime Minister's full statement that continues after the words in the question, quote, "when instead, through the Ministry of Social Development, someone can access the flexi-wage subsidy to start their own business and to support themselves as a self-employed person. They can also access through MSD a business startup fund that can give them up to $10,000 to start up their own business."
Does he think that starting a business in New Zealand under his government's policy settings is the equivalent of rolling a dice down at Sky City?
Mr. Speaker, no. On this side of the House, we understand that it's important that when you start a business, you've got the full support of the community around you, of the government. When it comes to Sky City, the gambling approach is that of the opposition, if I recall last term.
Supplementary.
I'll let him continue.
Does he think that starting a business under his government policy settings is the equivalent of buying a lotto ticket? And if so, what's he doing to reduce the odds?
Madam Speaker, no. What I think we're talking about here is a risky, uncosted policy put forward by the opposition that puts people's retirement savings at risk.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
I could ask the Minister of Finance as to whether the analogy of rolling the dice is one that comes to mind in a report to him, where at the end of the rolling of the dice we end up with a smaller convention centre.
Madam Speaker, that's right. All references to Sky City should be directed to Stephen Joyce.
Does he accept that everyone starting a business is taking a calculated risk? Will he find customers, or will she find customers or not? But that we won't advance as a country unless more people are prepared to take that risk.
Madam Speaker, every single person who decides to start a business is making a courageous decision and one that we should back. That's why we have facilities through MSD and elsewhere to support that. What should not be put at risk is their retirement security, which unfortunately the opposition seem to want to do here, and because they've decided they don't want to contribute to the super fund.
What's wrong with allowing people who have lost their jobs during a 1-in-100-year event, as he himself describes it, to draw on their KiwiSaver funds to start a business if they back themselves to have a go?
Yeah. Madam Speaker, we will back them to have a go, but what we will not do is risk up to $60,000 worth of their future retirement income that they need.
Doesn't he agree that we'll get more jobs created if we focus on making it easier for businesses to succeed, by keeping taxes low, by pushing back at regulation, and by allowing investment to flow? Do that.
Madam Speaker, we're very focused on this side of the House on helping businesses succeed, and I invite the member to take a look at the Zero Small Business Insights report that has been released that shows that Kiwi small businesses are recovering better than those in the UK and Australia.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Is the Minister aware of any initiatives this government has put in place over the COVID period to help small businesses succeed through the COVID phase?
Madam Speaker, many, and I don't think you'll let me run through them all, but for example, the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme and the wide variety of tax measures that have put money back in the pockets of New Zealanders, thanks in part to the Minister of Revenue.
Does he think that small business owners around the country should be thanking their lucky stars that he is the Minister of Finance every day and that all the progress that has been made is due to the hard work of his government?
Madam Speaker, the progress that has been made is due to the hard work of the team of 5 million, and in the case of myself, the Kumara does not speak of how sweet it is.
Madam Speaker.
Question number 5, I call Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development. What recent announcements has she made about putting children first as part of the government's welfare overhaul?
Madam Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Yesterday I announced that this government is putting children first and making our welfare system fairer by removing the punitive subsequent child policy. The subsequent child policy was introduced in 2012. The policy has meant that parents who have a subsequent child whilst on a benefit have work obligations imposed on them earlier from when their youngest child is just 1 year old. And depending on the age of their next oldest child, this can also affect their eligibility for the sole parent support benefit. This is a policy that has furthered inequities in the welfare system for parents and their children, undermined the value of parenting, and exacerbated stigma and stress for many families.
Supplementary, what difference will this make for parents and children?
Madam Speaker, the subsequent child policy has a disproportionate effect on Māori women. By removing the policy, we can further our commitment to improving outcomes for Māori and valuing the role of carers, who are predominantly women. The first 1,000 days of a child's life are critical for their long-term development. It is not fair that these children might not be given the same time and support simply because they were born while their parents were on a benefit. Removing the subsequent child policy will give the estimated 9,000 parents affected the flexibility to be carers. However, the removal of this policy does not preclude parents who are able to work from getting access to the employment and upskilling support from MSD that this government has significantly bolstered investment in.
Supplementary, why is the subsequent child policy being removed?
Madam Speaker, MSD has found no evidence that the subsequent child policy has positively impacted financial or social outcomes for those affected. This highlights for me how punitive policies, underpinned by judgment of those in our welfare system, are ineffective and only serve to stigmatise people who in this case have been disproportionately Māori women. Under our confidence and supply agreement, this government has committed to creating a fairer and better welfare system and removing excessive sanctions.
I think the member has answered the question. Thank you. Point of order?
I'd like to finish my answer.
I'm sorry, but I think the member has already answered.
Point of order, Madam Speaker.
No, I'm not.
Actually,
no,
my word count.
I'm sorry. Sit down. Sit down. It was a very long answer. It was a very simple question, much of which the member's answer had already been stated. I think the answer has been completed. Madam Speaker. Question number 6, Jan Logie.
My question is to the Associate Minister for the Environment and asks, is regulated product stewardship useful for reducing waste to landfill? If so, why?
The Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Yes, regulated product stewardship helps put the responsibility for waste and what happens to products at the end of their useful life on manufacturers, brand owners, retailers and users, rather than on communities, councils, neighbourhoods and nature. Regulated product stewardship schemes for challenging products such as agrochemicals and their containers, tyres, refrigerants, farm plastics, computers, TVs and other electronic goods will help ensure that these products currently lost to landfill or sometimes dumped irresponsibly are recovered and the materials in them reprocessed or reused. Regulated product stewardship asks businesses to be responsible producers so we can all be responsible consumers.
Supplementary. Why were the priority products chosen?
The Ministry for the Environment consulted with the public and stakeholders to identify products which harm the environment through poor disposal, products which would benefit from resource efficiency and from a regulated scheme. Industry readiness and active engagement of stakeholders to ensure a successful scheme was also considered. The 6 product types I announced yesterday, tyres, electrical and electronic products, agrochemicals and their containers, refrigerants, farm plastics and plastic packaging, can all cause environmental harm, and the relevant sectors are actively engaged in either planning or development or developing product stewardship schemes. And that's what we want, to work in partnership with businesses and stakeholders for robust schemes which create jobs, make our economy more efficient and reduce waste to landfill.
How does mandatory product stewardship create jobs and innovation?
Businesses like E-Waste Services in Porirua, in the heart of the Mana electorate, which I visited yesterday, are just one example. What started as one person in a home-based business recovering computers has recently expanded to employ 12 people, and they anticipate doubling their staff in 12 months. The business employs people like Wayne, who used to be a truck driver. He loves his job, pulling apart TVs and computers, separating out screws and other metals, circuit boards to send away for reprocessing to recover precious metals such as gold, and helping the planet.
Supplementary. How does this help fulfil the confidence in supply and coalition agreements?
Madam Speaker, when it comes to tyres, all parties of government agree that product stewardship is an important part of reducing environmental harm. The Greens' confidence in supply agreement commits to minimising waste to landfill, and New Zealand First coalition agreement commits to tyre stewardship. Moving to mandatory product stewardship for these 6 product streams helps fulfil both these commitments.
Question number 7 is in the name of Chris Bishop.
I sort of wanted that one to keep going. Okay, thank you, Madam Speaker.
That was unnecessary.
Okay. It's the spirit of Thursday, Madam Speaker, but thank you. To the Minister for Infrastructure, will the full list of the more than 150 shovel-ready projects be announced before Parliament dissolves? And how many of these projects are currently scheduled for announcement by government ministers or under-secretaries?
Oh, the Honourable Grant Robertson.
On behalf of the Minister, yes. While there may be one or two exceptions, the vast majority will be announced before Parliament dissolves. In answer to the second part of the question, as the member would know from having worked in a ministerial office, announcements are scheduled once the subject of the announcement is finalised. As several ministers have told the member, some of the projects agreed in principle are still being finalised and will be announced in due course. Yesterday we had announced 79 projects, today that number is up to 84, and several more will come over the coming days.
How many of the how many of the 70 signed off but unannounced shovel-ready projects are currently scheduled for announcement in light of three projects being announced by three different ministers in three different locations since I asked this yesterday?
Well, Madam Speaker, I think the member's answering his own question there. The announcements are being rolled out over the coming days, and as I said, almost all will be announced by the time Parliament dissolves, and they are being welcomed, Madam Speaker, widely in the community, particularly today in Nainai.
When was due diligence completed on the Paihia waterfront project that he announced this morning?
Madam Speaker, the member would accept, I think, with a fairly general question that asking a very specific matter like that, I'll have to get back to him on.
Why did it take 9 days to announce the Paihia project this morning when invitations to the launch event went out on the 21st of July?
Madam Speaker, I think this is where the member is misunderstanding the whole fund here. Communities want announcements for these projects because they're a cause for celebration, and they want to make sure the whole community can be invited along to celebrate that there's a government that backs them.
Point of order, Chris Bishop.
That was a very interesting answer, but the question was about the gap between the 21st of July, when the invitations were issued for the Paihia project, and today, which is the 30th of July, and why there was a 9-day gap.
I think the Minister did address that, though, by referring to the fact that if you want a lot of people, then you need to give them a lot of notice.
How many further shovel-ready projects will be drip-fed to the public over the coming weeks, in the light of three ministers making three announcements in three different locations this morning?
Madam Speaker, as I answered in the previous several answers, all of the projects, perhaps bar one or two, will be announced before Parliament dissolves. And I thank the member on behalf of the government for his efforts to publicise these excellent projects all around New Zealand.
Can he assure the House that the availability of ministers and their diaries has in no way impeded or delayed any possible announcements, given the Prime Minister has said we are moving as swiftly as we can?
Madam Speaker, there is no sense of this government impeding infrastructure. We're the ones promoting it.
Question number 8, the Honourable Michael Wodehouse.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development. Does he stand by his statement about the number of jobs the Provincial Growth Fund will create? Quote, 10,000 as an estimate over the life of the fund, end quote. And if so, what is the source of the information that informed his answer?
On behalf of the Minister,
may I
pass on my congratulations for his newfound spokesmanship. Over a year ago, we set the record straight after the National Party used numbers that were not correct with respect to the amount of jobs that would be generated by the Provincial Growth Fund. At that time, we estimated that 10,000 jobs would be created. This was the information we had at the time from the applicants. I know you're a complete mess. You look at it every time you look in the mirror. The kinds of rural businesses that the opposition claims to support just are not correct.
Well, which number is correct? The 10,000 mentioned yesterday, the 2,727 on the PGF website, or the 13,000 quoted by the Prime Minister in question two today?
The Prime Minister just happens to be more up to date than some ministers. On behalf of the Minister, initial work done by applicants as part of their submissions to the Provincial Development Unit shows that over 10,000 jobs may be created as a result of the PGF investment. And this includes jobs created in the construction and delivery of projects and across the wider economy. I can say that there's a stock take being done right now so that the figures can be given out very, very soon. And what we are certain of, no, not knowing is the specialty of that member, and has been the whole time since he arrived in Parliament.
Order.
And
order.
Shouting out and making a fool of himself is his penchant every day he arrives in Parliament.
Order.
But here we're back to the facts.
Can I just interrupt the member? We will not have personal reflections, thank you. Just answer the question.
Point of order. We won't have interjections like that either, without you stopping them, Madam Chair, with the greatest respect. That's what your role is. This is about information which is entitled to be heard by other members without five or six people shouting out constantly. Surely that's the way it should be run.
The standing orders do allow interjections while the member is answering a question. I would ask the member to get on with answering the questions and stop personal reflection.
The standing orders talk about being reasonable.
Are you
when
arguing?
You say that. No, I'm not arguing with you.
Well,
I'm just telling you the facts. Now, can I just say further, we are doing a stock take. It looks like the figures will be far greater than we ourselves imagine, and only the conservatism and modesty of getting it wrong in terms of understating the tremendous performance requires me not to answer the question now. But in a matter of days, as the development unit, provincial unit development unit personality Robert Pigot said, these figures will be out, and they'll be a matter of enormous credit to the government.
To the Minister, does he believe the PGF is good value for jobs created when the best estimate, depending on which number we use, is between 300,000 and 900,000 per job, when the jobs in the broader economy come at about 116,000 per job?
On behalf of the Minister, the fact that the Member is now starting to quote figures from a former spokesmanship which were wrong as well. The truth is the Provincial Growth Fund and the PDU know with precision what the numbers are going to be, and they're looking to be far greater than we ever thought ourselves. Oh, Mr. Smith, this is a member who got another member into trouble. He quoted 31,000 houses.
Order.
That member
order,
went on.
Order. Now, I'm not going to remind the member again. Can he just focus on answering the question? I appreciate there was an interjection, but the member does not have to respond with personal abuse.
Point of order.
Point of order.
Madam Chair, for the second time, I pointed out to you the long-standing impropriety of a member moving their seat to get a better position to heckle. I've asked you once, I'm asking you again, are you going to act on that or not?
No, I am not going to act on a member interjecting during the answer to a question. I'm asking the member not to get involved in personal reflections, just simply to answer the question and ignore any interjections.
Point of order, Madam Chair.
Madam Speaker, I'm not going to
stand here and have a barrage of criticism and be told I can't do what every other parliamentarian has been allowed down through, dare I say it, over a century in this country, a chance to respond to unreasonable behaviour.
Just because you've done something many times, it doesn't make it right. In this Parliament, we are not going to have personal reflection. Have you finished your answer? Supplementary question, the Honourable Tracy Martin.
Kia ora, thank you. Can the Minister confirm that when one is working out the amount per job that would be created by the Provincial Growth Fund, one must take into account the original investment of the Provincial Growth Fund, the lifetime of the project and the number of people who would be employed over the lifetime, not only of creating the project, but then working, for example, in the largest aquaculture factory in Opotiki, to be able to come up with a figure per job?
On behalf of the Minister,
point of order?
Point of order, Chris Bishop.
I think there are about six legs to that question, and Mr. Speaker has ruled that supplementary questions can have two legs to them, and there are about six in there.
Yeah, but that is my responsibility to make that decision. You can answer.
On behalf of the Minister, I want to thank that member for enunciating with precision and exactitude exactly how you calculate the workforce derived from such magnificent investment.
Does the PGF give priority to projects that will create more jobs? If not, why not?
On behalf of the Minister, of course the PGF gives priority for jobs because we don't have any projects without jobs.
And that answer is the reason he isn't able to provide a better estimate of the number of jobs created by the PGF is that the application form doesn't even require applicants to provide that information.
On behalf of the Minister, it is taken as read that anybody that has got any commercial understanding knows that every business has jobs. There is no business I know in the world with no work, no workforce and no jobs. I mean, it's axiomatic, and why members over there are laughing is beyond me.
Question number 9, Dr. Duncan Webb.
Oh, thank you, Madam Speaker. My question is for the Minister of the Environment. What announcements has the government made regarding reform of the Resource Management Act 1991?
Speaker.
I call the Honourable David Parker.
Madam Speaker, yesterday the government published the most comprehensive review of the resource management system since the RMA was passed in 1991. The independent review was chaired by former Court of Appeal Judge Tony Randerson QC, and it proposes that the RMA be repealed and replaced with two main acts. We agree with the panel that this reform is needed. The RMA has doubled in size from its original length. It's become too costly, takes too long, has not adequately protected the environment. If we're fortunate enough to be re-elected, we're committed to implementing many of the recommendations in the report.
What does the review panel propose should replace the RMA?
Madam Speaker, the main recommendation is the replacement of the existing RMA with two pieces of legislation, a Natural and Built Environments Act and a Strategic Planning Act. The proposed Natural and Built Environments Act would address urban issues like housing and enhancing the quality of natural environments to better achieve or to achieve better outcomes for present and future generations. The proposed Strategic Planning Act would set long-term strategic goals and help integrate legislative functions across the resource management system, including the proposed NBA, the Local Government Act, the Land Transport Management Act, and the Climate Change Response Act. This will ensure better planning, including for infrastructure and housing investment. The panel also recommends greater use of national direction by the Environment Minister, a more streamlined process for council plan making, and more efficient resource consent processes.
What changes are proposed around district plans?
The panel proposes that there be a single plan for each region, encompassing rules for each district in that region. This would reduce the number of RMA plans from over 100 to 14. The report recommends alternative dispute resolution mechanisms to resolve boundary disputes, such as the height and proximity of adjacent buildings.
What is recommended to improve environmental outcomes?
Madam Chair, a common criticism of the existing RMA is that it has not dealt well with cumulative effects, which have worsened since the RMA was enacted, especially in water and climate change. To remedy this, the report recommends a change in focus from effects to outcomes, and those outcomes will be underpinned by environmental bottom lines set out in national direction.
And how does this plan compare with other plans to reform the RMA?
Madam Speaker, this government is comprehensively redesigning the resource management system to deliver better outcomes for the environment and housing, to help people and the economy, as well as protect the environment. The review and recommendations are wide-ranging, and I would like to thank the panel members for their constructive and dedicated work in providing solutions for the next government to implement. I understand the other side of the House also wishes to repeal the RMA and put out press release mistakenly claiming this proposed reform.
I just bring to the attention of the member the Speaker's ruling that I referred to before, and there is another Speaker's ruling that says it's unreasonable to use questions from the governing party to attack the opposition.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Speaker, whoever is the next government, they will have the opportunity to implement this review inside 3 years, compared with nothing done over the last nine by the prior government.
Question number 10, Brett Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Wonderful to see you in the chair. To the Minister of Health, does he have confidence that enough New Zealanders are downloading and using the official NZ COVID Tracer app for it to be effective in the event of an outbreak of community transmission?
Madam Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Madam Speaker, no. But it is important to remember that the COVID Tracer app is just one of the tools that are available to us. The work of the public health units and the National Close Contact Service remain the mainstays of our contact tracing, and I have confidence in the effectiveness of their work. The more people that are using the app, the more useful it will be. I do encourage people to download it, install it and use it every day. And I note that the latest update, which allows people to add in manual contacts where there is no QR code, is now live.
Supplementary. Has he sought confirmation that all ministers are using the COVID Tracer app and scan each QR code they come in contact with? And if so, are they doing so?
Mr. Speaker, I can speak for myself and say that I have downloaded it, I've registered it, and I use it regularly, Madam Speaker. And I expect all other members of the House to do the same.
Point of order, Madam Speaker. He didn't address the part said, has he sought confirmation from his ministerial colleagues?
Do you want to just repeat your question? I'm sorry.
Thank you. Has he sought confirmation that all ministers are using the COVID Tracer app to scan each QR code they come in contact with? And if so, are they doing so?
Yeah, I think the Minister does need to address that.
Well, Madam Speaker, no, I haven't. I don't have ministerial responsibility for whether or not ministers use the app, although I have been told by many of them sitting around me that they are using it. And I can, in fact, attest to the fact that the Prime Minister reminded everybody in her party, including the media, to use it this morning when we visited the wonderful trade kitchen in Nainai.
To have confidence in the app when he can't even confirm if members of the government are using it.
Mr. Speaker, I can't confirm that members of the opposition are using it either. I'm not the police in this regard. I do encourage all members to use it.
Supplementary. How many of the 621,400 registered users who have downloaded the app are using it to scan QR codes on a regular basis?
Mr. Speaker, I did go through this with the member's colleague, Dr. Retty, when he asked this question. We don't actually collect that data. That data is held by the individuals on their phones.
Supplementary. How can the public have confidence in the app if he doesn't even know if people are using it?
Madam Speaker. Force of habit.
A bit of muscle memory there.
Madam Speaker, I think I answered that question earlier. One of the things about the app, which is important, is that people record their own data and they have control over their own data.
Question number 11, Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. What reports has he seen about police efforts to prevent and respond to methamphetamine harm in the community?
Honourable Stuart Nash.
Madam Speaker, before I answer this question, I just want to acknowledge the passing of an All Black great and Andy Hayden, one of the game's true legends. Madam Speaker, I have seen numerous reports that affirm this government's commitment to preventing and responding to the damage methamphetamine is causing to our communities. As referenced in the House yesterday by the Minister for Regional Economic Development, the government has invested an additional $20 million in regional programs to reduce the damage meth is causing. This includes upgrades to residential facilities that support detoxification, rehabilitation and re-engagement with the community for recovering meth users, as well as an extension to the collaboration between DHBs and police in Northland with the Te Ara Oranga program. Reports show that a staggering 1.8 tonnes of meth was seized by police and customs during 2019, three times as much as the previous year. And in the first half of 2020, police busted 38 clandestine meth labs. To effectively deal with the scourge of meth, we need to attack the supply and reduce demand. This government is committed to supporting enforcement agencies, iwi, non-government organisations and the community to do just that.
Supplementary question. How has the increase in police numbers helped prevent and respond to methamphetamine harm in the community?
Madam Speaker, under this government there has been a 14% increase in police numbers nationwide. 700 of these officers are being dedicated to organised crime. To put that increase in the context of reducing the harm from meth, this means that the National Organised Crime Group has now expanded into the districts to help disrupt meth supply. A new dedicated team has been set up in the South Island and police are looking to set up a new team in the Waikato district. A Pacific Transnational Organised Crime Team has been established and is co-located with Customs in Auckland. Two United States DEA officers are also expected later this year to further help disrupt the transnational supply of meth and other drugs. The establishment of a multi-agency working group that includes New Zealand Customs, Department of Corrections, MB and the Institute of Environmental Science and Research to deliver this government's methamphetamine manufacture disruption action plan. This, Madam Speaker, is what is possible when you fund an agency and rebuild their workforce after years of neglect.
Further supplementary, what recent initiatives has the government announced to help detect and disrupt the supply of methamphetamine and other drugs in the community?
Madam Speaker, today police and ESR announced the development of a drug screening solution which allows frontline officers working in our communities to carry out real-time testing of drugs. In a world-leading initiative for law enforcement, the New Zealand Police have collaborated with ESR in trialling the Lumi drug scan device, which has enabled officers to test for the most common drugs on the streets using a handheld device and receive almost instant results through their work-issued mobile phones. Lumi can test for methamphetamine, MDMA and cocaine, three of the most common and harmful drugs on the New Zealand market. I'm also pleased to have announced with the Associate Transport Minister, Julianne Genta, the introduction of the Land Transfer Drug Driving Amendment Bill today. Last year, Madam Speaker, 103 people died in crashes where the driver was later found to have drugs in their system.
Ministers can actually use press releases to make announcements. Question number 12, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Would the repeal of the Electoral Integrity Amendment Act 2018 improve New Zealand's democracy?
Madam Speaker.
I call the Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Madam Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Justice, no, and I think the rationale for that summed up in the name of Mr Carter's bill.
Is the repeal of the Electoral Integrity Law consistent with the government's coalition agreement?
Mr Speaker, the government's coalition agreement was to pass the law in the first place.
Does he accept a majority of this parliament does not support the government's Electoral Integrity Act 2018?
The voting record in the parliament would suggest otherwise.
Can he name any other occasion in the 24-year history of MMP when the government has lost a vote on a core supply and confidence commitment?
Madam Speaker, we didn't, and I'd point out that the bill hasn't passed.
It's passed its first reading. Does he agree with the statement of the Green Party that the government's electoral integrity law is fundamentally inconsistent with democracy and free speech?
Madam Speaker, no.
And I'm not sure that he has any responsibility for the Green Party.
Madam Speaker, I understand you could ask within a minister's responsibility questions in response to statements.
Is this a point of order or a conversation?
Happy to have both. Does the minister agree with the International Parliamentary Union, representing 167 parliaments and 16,000 parliamentarians, including every member of this House, that laws enabling parliamentarians to be dismissed by their party or leader undermine a basic principle of democracy?
Madam Speaker, I reject the assertion that that's what the law change does.
I think you've used them all up. That concludes oral questions. Phew.